Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcast network.
Start talking about emotion. It's funny. The book used to split it into two, into motivation and emotion. I believe now it's one chapter, right? Which is good. For the longest time, in fact, even our program here at the university, we split motivation and emotion into two different classes, and I kind of wonder why. And I'll make that point a little bit today. And if my mouse ever associates, come on. That's not helping at all. Man. Well, this isn't very much fun. Who can I blame that on? Come on. So what are emotions? I'm about to have an angry Americos. Emotions are a mix of the following. I mean, this is one way to look at it anyway. Physiological arousal of some sort, like you just saw me have. The behavior itself. Now, you think of something like, well, and also the experience. So let's say everyone really happy, right? Let's say you're a New Orleans Saints fan, and you watched Super Bowl last night, and Saints won, and yada, yada, yada. You would have felt your heart beating quickly, right? You probably felt your mouth get a little bit dry, or maybe you just won money on the game. There's not a whole lot of Saints fans probably outside New Orleans, but, you know, I think everybody likes the Saints with Katrina and all. So heart beats fast. You might even notice that things seem brighter because your pupils dilate. Right? There's the physiological part of it. There's the behavior. So you're happy, you're laughing, you're cheering. And then there's the experience, which is a little bit harder to nail down. But I mean, if we looked at the physiological arousal involved in fear, it's not a great deal different. There's the physiological arousal there, is your heart beating faster, your pupils dilate, mouth gets a little dry. Right? You get those things. Plus, so that the physiologically looks the same. Behaviorally, quite a bit different. You might hide. I don't know. And the experience of fear, actual fear, is a great deal different, of course, than the experience of, like, joy. So the physiology is pretty similar at a very basic level. Well, no, I guess I shouldn't say that. The physiology is the same as far as the arousal part of it. There's got to be something else with physiology, with the experience and the behavior that comes in there, because at some level it's all physiology. But the overall arousal is roughly the same. So it's kind of interesting that way. Now, the standard social science model approach, the way most social scientists approach emotion, and yes, that's a slide that wasn't on the internet, so I've just added that one, is... when we think about motivation and emotion, and trying to put them together, motivation is what energizes behavior, which is what we talked about. And emotions are a combination of arousal, behavior, and experience. In other words, what I've just said over the last three classes, really. Well, two classes and 5 minutes. Right? That motivation energizes behavior, and that emotions are a combination of arousal, behavior, and experience. And that's led to a lot of very fruitful research and some pretty decent ideas. So SSSM just means Standard Social Science Model. That's the standard approach that's being taken. Should motivation and emotion really be considered separate things, though? And as I said, one of the reasons that I do it as separate parts is because, in fact, at the university, we have a course in motivation and a course in emotion. Should they be separate things? I kind of like to think of it this way. We could probably think of emotions as the behavioral response to our goals being either advanced or hindered, right? So we've got goal-directed behavior, which is energized by, when we think about this sort of classic approach, by emotion. So something good happens to you. That's your goal being advanced. Maybe you won $20 on the game last night. And therefore, you have this behavioral response to it. I think that's a little bit better than sort of splitting them, because they're so hard to split. It's kind of like splitting memory and learning. You can do it, or perception and sensation, which is another one. And again, we do that totally in our programs. It's not like we're doing anything radical here. It's a standard approach, but you wonder where does perception end, where does sort of sensation end, where does perception begin, where does learning end, where does memory begin, where do motivations end, and emotions begin. Kind of hard to split them up. So I think that's probably a bit better of an approach, and I'll kind of be taking that approach a little. And the book does a decent job of doing that now too, which is nice because it used to do this old sort of splitting everything up, which I wasn't quite as fond of. What emotions do is they guide behavior a lot of times. Right? Emotions guide behavior. Now think about this. If you're angry about something, it leads you to do something else. You think about if you're in a situation where you're really mad and you're going to break something. You ever had that one? You're so mad you're going to break something. And your emotion of anger actually guides your behavior. And the weird thing is, in fact, a lot of the time, the behavior is stupid and you know it as you're doing it. Right? You ever do something like you punch a wall? I've done that. My fist through a wall once. That was, by the way, that's called being stupid. I put my head through a wall once. I used to have really, real bad anger issues. They're pretty much, therapy took care of that. But I used to have a real anger problem. Which I believe I inherited from my father, who I remember once getting angry with a pop rivet gun. You know, pop rivets, like a little nail, and then it pulls the pop rivet. And there are these two little teeth in this little air gun. They're just little, and they're about that big, like they're a couple of millimeters. And they get out of alignment now and then, and you got to take the whole gun apart and realign them. So this was upsetting to my father, who, you know, he had an anger problem too, let's just say that. Worse than I ever had. And we were making flight cases because that was a company he had, and that was my sort of summer job, and you can never call in sick or hungover to your father. Doesn't work, by the way, just as an aside. We're pulling these rivets. The teeth get out of alignment for the third time we're building this case. He opens the thing up, takes the teeth out, and says, "I don't know why the F I'm doing this," and throws them across the shop. Of course, now they're gone. Production shuts down for a week. And as he did it, it guided his behavior, his anger. And he's literally said, "I don't know why I'm doing this." And he threw it. So your emotion can guide your behavior almost at a sort of guttural level. And the cool thing about these things is that a lot of times we can think of emotions as being something from our evolutionary past that still is pretty useful. But it's like, you know, when you corner a dog and it gets that response, it's that same kind of thing. It may be your dog. The dog may love you. I don't know if dogs love, but you know, that kind of thing. But the dog still, if you corner it, it's done something bad. We used to have a dog that when you peed on the floor, and if you got a paper towel, it got mad at you. And it'll go, "Rrr." But I think the dog still liked this. Same kind of thing. So it's like, it's almost primitive, and primitive just means old. Right? So I think sort of a little bit better approach is that sort of more of a integrative approach, more integration of the two, of emotion and motivation. I'll try to take that tack a little bit, because like I said, I think the book does that now, and that's a good thing. Questions about that? Make sense? All right. Physiology of emotion. What happens when we have strong emotion? Well, first of all, extra sugar is made available to the body for energy. We breathe faster. And again, if you've ever been really, really, really excited, like happy, or in fact, you notice this perhaps a little bit more because the experience is different, with real anger or real fear. Right? If you're the kind of person who doesn't like to give a talk in front of a class, and then you have to give a presentation, you know, and you know it. You know it. Up here, you know it. It's the same kind of thing as my dad throwing the little teeth in the pop rivet gun. You know you'll do okay. You know it. You get up there, and I introduce you, you know, in upper year classes where I make people give presentations, and suddenly you're like, and you're breathing really quickly. Mouth's dry. Your digestion actually slows. Evolutionarily, this is great.
One sec.
Because in evolutionary history, it wasn't we were afraid of presentations. We were afraid of saber-toothed tigers. Yeah.
Would anxiety be considered an emotion?
I think when you think, I think anxiety more generally, it's more like the physiological part of it without a lot of the experiential part, it seems to me, because we've got like things like being nervous, being anxious, but then there's sort of what you know clinically is called free-floating anxiety, and that's when people have an anxiety disorder, when they're just anxious all the time, and they even know, again, same sort of thing, for no apparent reason, people know why, there's no reason for me to be anxious, I just am. Right? There, it's sort of clinical, so I think you can get out of hand. Is it an emotion in and of itself?
Is it a combination of emotions, maybe?
Oh, I think it's more just the physiological part without the label. Okay. Right? So it's without the experience. There's an experience there, but without the sort of emotional experience and without the behavioral part of it. Because when people get really anxious over stuff, they don't tend to have a similar behavioral response. It depends a lot on the situation. So if you're anxious about a test, you will get this. If you're anxious about speaking in front of people, you'll get this. Right? Sometimes we might want to call that fear. Right? But other times it might be something else. That's a good question. Your digestion slows, like I said, makes a lot of sense because in our past, when something was threatening to us, it wasn't a presentation you had to give to your, what would they probably call themselves? Clan. I'm thinking about, 150,000 years ago. They probably called it a clan. It was probably in some other language, though. I don't think anybody spoke English back then. It was because they were out hunting and, there were saber-toothed tigers around. And that's scary. Digestion slows because you need to work. Your body has to, like, okay, I got a decision to make. Either I digest food slowly or I allow this guy to run like hell. If I allow him to digest food slowly and he can't use all his powers to run away, he's dead. So you can see how in our past it made a great deal of sense to get, don't worry about digestion right now. You can worry about that later because you'll be dead shortly if you don't run away or fight. Your pupils dilate. This is probably allowing us to get more information into our, this is a guess, to get more information into our system. You sweat. This is basically your autonomic nervous system, and it's the sympathetic part of the autonomic nervous system, not the parasympathetic, which is the cool-down one. And in fact, we'll talk about stress later in the course, and in fact, this is not the best thing in the world to happen all the time, because it's adaptive, clearly. But it's not adaptive when you're getting up in front of people to speak. It's adaptive when someone's trying to kill you. Right? But remember, for the most of our evolutionary history, we weren't giving presentations. We were getting killed or doing killing. One or the other. This is basically mediated by the, in this case they're acting as hormones, epinephrine and norepinephrine in the bloodstream. That's adrenaline. Yep.
Those are your fight or flight.
That's exactly. Fight or flight response. Exactly what it is. So fight or flight response. People sometimes say they can taste a tinny taste in their mouth when they're really anxious. That's the taste of adrenaline. That's epinephrine. Because this is all mediated by hormones, it's actually a little slow. It's not an immediate reaction. And this will happen, for example, again, when you're going to give a talk in class, it doesn't act, it may not even, in fact, this is quite common, it doesn't, people don't get nervous until they start talking. Or a couple of slides in, if they're doing PowerPoint, or a couple of sentences in. Because it takes 45 seconds, a minute, for this thing to actually work. And this happens, and I think I talked about this last term, if you've ever had a near miss driving a car and someone almost hits you when you're driving the car, you should probably pull over anyway, even though you're safe. Because what's going to happen in a second is all this stuff, and it's going to be hard to concentrate on driving. And I remember this happening. I think I told you guys this on Highway 69 once when my wife expertly avoided a truck. And I said to her, you are about to feel very uncomfortable and anxious. It's okay. It's totally normal. But remember that you're going to feel that way. And if you want, you can pull over. And we totally understand it and everything. And she's like, what do you mean? What do you mean? Oh, my God. Here it comes, right? And next time that something like this happens to you, and I know it's a horrible thing to think of, and usually when these kind of things are happening, you can't think, oh, yeah, Dave said that in class. I should keep that in mind. But if it does happen, it's really bizarre, but it actually makes sense because it takes a long time. It's a hormonal system. So, the fight-or-flight response kicks in. And this is typically what we might call strong emotions. This can be excitement, joy, anger, fear, sexual arousal.
Would stress do the same thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, when this thing anytime this system kicks in, we call that stress. And if there really is something to be stressed about, this makes a great deal of sense. Because if you're actually running away from something or fighting it, you're using that energy. If you aren't, if what you're worrying about is that the guy in front of you can't remember his bank machine number, right? Or somebody in front of you is buying lottery tickets and they're taking forever and all you want to do is just buy a chocolate bar before you get on the bus to go to work. That may be a little personal. And you know the bus is coming and there's this guy going, no, I want that one and a quick pick four and the lotto this and you want to just haul off and hit him. That's actually stupid. Right, and I mean, I know it's funny how I sit there and I think, don't get angry. There's no reason to get stressed out. This isn't a threatening situation. But I wish you'd hurry up! You know? That's a different deal. And I mean, then it mediates anger. But the thing is, the anger has no, and I don't want to say outlet because it doesn't really work that way. But all that arousal, you should use it to run. You shouldn't use it to. Because what happens is all kinds of bad things can happen to you. You get a release of cortisol, which is actually bad for your brain. Things like that. We've talked about this before. Any questions about this? Good question. Other questions? Yeah? Good? All right. The Yerkes-Dodson Law, this is the idea of too much arousal is not good. And not enough arousal is not good. Somewhere in the middle is pretty much what you're looking for. So this is for any task that you aren't an expert at. So it's true for most tasks. It's true for most tasks. And especially think of something like test-taking behavior. This is perfect. You want to be a little bit fired up. Not so much that you can't think straight. That's no good. But enough that you're, you know, come on, coach, put me in. That kind of feeling, you know? Ask me some questions. I know the answers. Let's go. That's kind of cool. And you want that. That's actually good for you. That's good for you. You don't want so much that you have a panic attack, basically. You don't want so little that you don't care, that you don't try. That it's like you're asleep. Because hardly any arousal is asleep. You want something in the middle. So just that physiological system itself, devoid of what we might call emotion, you just want a little bit of arousal. For tasks that are overlearned, the more arousal the better, obviously to a point. But overlearned tasks, what's overlearning? This is when you take something like, you already know how to do it and do it perfectly, and you keep practicing. No, not so much like that. More like something like professional athlete, right? Sidney Crosby does not need to practice playing hockey. He's already quite good at it. And as we saw yesterday, so is Alexander Ovechkin. Unfortunately, he's Russian. I'm just, getting into the nationalistic jingoistic ridiculousness for the Olympics coming up. Nothing better than petty bourgeois nationalism once every 4 years. It's amazing, we're such a pleasant people until we see people with hockey sticks in their hands. And then we become barbarians as Canadians. And I'm all for it, don't misunderstand me. Sidney Crosby doesn't need to practice. Alex Ovechkin doesn't need to practice. They're already quite good, thank you. Right? They overlearn the tasks. Going around pylons and doing passing drills for someone who's one of the best hockey players in the world is useless as far as teaching him anything else. It's unlikely he's going to learn anything. Right? Now, if he got... Now, obviously, this gets to a point. But he gets this overlearned task. That's what I'm saying here. Eventually, it gets to a point, clearly, if he had too much arousal, he couldn't skate. So, it's a little bit specious of me to say overlearned tasks, the more arousal, the better, because, in fact, at some point, it's going to be too much. But instead of being like this, it's more like it goes up, 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 up. It will eventually just drop down. This is the same reason that people like in the military train and train and train and train and train. Because I'm thinking it's kind of stressful being shot at. This is just a guess, but it's stressful enough playing like Team Deathmatch Modern Warfare 2. That's stressful enough. You can't really die. It's amazing if you've ever heard, and sometimes you can hear these things, it does happen, where if you can hear transcripts, not transcripts, but you actually hear recordings of soldiers. Typically you don't hear those, typically you hear like fighter pilots. And it's amazing how quickly you hear them breathe. And they're also pulling G's and going, you know, 1,200 kilometers an hour. But I remember hearing one during the 1991 Persian Gulf War, and it was, a Saudi pilot was going to shoot down an Iraqi plane. And his breathing was like, you could hear it like that, but he also very calmly said, Fox 2, as he launched two missiles, but he's like, and he shot down a couple of planes. It's incredible. And when you hear these guys talking, when they come back, it's like, have you ever talked to anybody who's ever been in battle? Which is kind of an experience you might want to do just because then it might make you never want to ever have a war. And they'll tell you, oh yeah, you're nervous, you're scared. If you're not scared, you're stupid. People pee their pants. People, it just happens all the time. You just learn to, you're trained so much that it just goes on automatic. They're overtrained, right? Overlearned. Same thing happens to professional athletes. Right? Things like that. So, and again, at some level, there's too much. It's going to drop right off. But that's just the raw arousal. There is emotion there. I'm sure there's fear. There's sort of generalized excitement. Right? But emotions themselves are a bit of a riddle. Because it's hard to pick out who's angry or scared or sexually aroused by looking at physiological reactions. So if you had someone hooked up to a polygraph, which we tend to think of as a lie detector, right? Which is measuring, it measures how much you sweat, it measures your heartbeat, and it measures your blood pressure. That's what it's doing. That's that thing's job. Somebody could be angry, they could be afraid. That's when they're lying, for example. Or they could be sexually aroused, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference reading with the readout, even if you were an expert. They certainly feel different, though. We've all been angry, we've all been scared, sexually aroused. We know they feel different. So experientially, quite different things. And different brain regions light up, which is interesting. So while the physiological system that kicks in, the sort of sympathetic nervous system that kicks in, is the same system all the time, different brain regions are lighting up. So you're thinking, why don't we use an MRI as a lie detector? Because we don't know when people are lying necessarily. It's also the case, by the way, that usually you can detect when someone's lying with an MRI. Not lying, having a false memory with an MRI. But that's only with like lists of words, and we've made you have a false memory of a word. So it's not like yet we can detect with an MRI that you're lying. And even if we could, we probably wouldn't do that because of fairness and justice and all that good stuff, which I think is probably good. So polygraphs work only on this stuff, right? Not on the brain stuff, but on the sort of arousal. GSR, galvanic skin response. All they do is they put some electrodes and they detect little, very small changes in your conductance of your skin. And why does that happen? Because sweat is salty. And salty water conducts electricity better than just skin. Right? Heartbeat, blood pressure, those kind of things. Detects that. Right? So generalized arousal, you can't tell the difference between that and arousal because you're lying. And this is why you always hear these old sort of stories about how to beat a polygraph. You know, you always hear people say things like, put a tack in your shoe, and every time they ask you a question, step on the tack, because the pain will get all that arousal happening. So every time you answer a question, you get the same thing. This is why they always tell you to relax. At least from what they see on TV. I mean, I've never had a lie detector test. It doesn't happen. Very uncommon. So it's hard to tell. So lie detectors, in fact, there's probably better ways to do it. And it's probably looking at sort of nonverbal communication. Because nonverbal communication and emotion also go together. One of the reasons, in fact, this is the... You know we're the only mammal that has whites to their eyes? You can see? Think about that for a second. Not really noticeable ones, though. It's mostly iris. Same with cats. Mostly iris. We have white parts to our eyes. A lot of other animals have yellow, different colors. We have dark color and what? Nice contrast. Right? Why would that be evolutionarily? Because we can actually look at each other and communicate things with our eyes. Other animals don't do that. I can look at you and just sort of look somewhere else, telling you to go do something. We can do things like roll our eyes because we're exasperated. Other animals can't do that. So something very special about the eye as far as using it for nonverbal communication, which is really quite cool. And when you think about it, there are so many things that you can do communicating just by looking and changing the way you gaze at something. Right? Not even changing your facial expression. Just like, that just means I'm pissed off at something when I do that, right? Or if I go like, I'm telling you to look over there. I was moving my eyes that way. I have little tiny eyes, so you probably couldn't tell. Good thing I wear glasses because it magnifies the size of my eyes. I have these abnormally small eyes. I'm a freak, really. I have a giant head and teeny eyes. I'm like some kind of weird cartoon. But why am I bringing this up? Because Kellerman, Lewis, and Laird did this really cool experiment in 89. I love this study. What they did, is they had people, undergraduate men and women, okay? So people like you guys, sit across from each other and talk, and they were told what to say. They had a script to read of a conversation, a very uninteresting, mundane conversation. I can't remember exactly what it was about, but we could pretend it was about the weather because it was something that mundane. Except in one group, they were told to look into each other's eyes. So they'd read what they're supposed to say, but then look into each other's eyes. In the other group, they were just told to read them. And then, you know, look up and whatever, just not given any instructions. The group that were told to look into each other's eyes, and then the other group, they're both given a test of how attractive they found the other person they were talking to. And if they were looking into each other's eyes and forced to do it and knew they were forced to do it, they found the other person more sexually attractive than if they did not look into their eyes. This is the uncomfortable part of the class where I try not to have eye contact with anyone because then everyone thinks I'm sexually harassing them. So that's amazing. Nonverbal communication can affect emotion. And people knew it. They were being forced to do it. It wasn't like, you know, they were, there was something surreptitious there. It was like, just look into their eyes when you say the words. Wow. There's knowledge you could perhaps use at a bar. I know you don't want to talk to me, if you just look into my eyes. That would be creepy, and you'd probably get you hit. And justifiably so, by the way. But I think that's amazing. That's pretty amazing. One of the things, in fact, that we always worry about when we're teaching, you know, I know you guys have probably been in classes where we rate full-time faculty members come in and rate part-time faculty members. We have to. You ever been in one of those yet? Maybe not. So we sit at the back of the room, a couple full-time people, and we fill out a little checklist. And one of the things we fill out is eye contact. Right? Because the data show that people that are rated as good teachers look at directly at individual students. Right? And it's kind of fun when you think that, like, oh, yeah, he's just teaching me. Right? And it's actually effective. Pretty cool. By the way, women are better than men at detecting emotion. And this shouldn't surprise anyone who's ever spent more than 20 minutes with a woman or a man. Right? You think about it, you go to a party and you're with your partner. So it could be your wife or a husband or a boyfriend or a girlfriend or perhaps all four. And woman will look at the guy, and women, you've been in this place, and so guys, you've been the same way. She'll say, let's pick a name. I don't think there's anybody named Sally in the class. Very uncommon name now. See, Sally seemed really upset today at the party. And the guy will look at you and go, what? Well, yeah, she was like really upset. Couldn't you tell? No, I was talking to her for half an hour. I didn't detect anything. I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, couldn't you just tell by the look on her face? I don't know what you're talking about. Right, so we've all had that experience because I see the sort of knowing laughter around the room, little pleasant smiles, or you're just humoring me, and that's pleasant of you as well. But the point is, the thing about this is that we detect, guys don't detect emotional changes as well as women do. And in fact, there are really good data on this. Really good data on this. How's it work? How do you test this? Well, an old student of mine tried this out. She had photoshopped pictures of people going from, she had a neutral face to a smile, or a neutral face to a frown. Okay? Very cool idea. And then what she did is she used Photoshop to develop a whole bunch of intermediate phases between being happy and being sad. And then animated it. Being happy, being neutral, being sad, being neutral. Starting at neutral, rather. And then saw when did the guys detect the change and when did the women detect the change, and the women do it better than the guys. They detect the change earlier than the guys do. That said, it's not like it's a huge difference, but it is a real difference. This makes, again, a lot of evolutionary sense. Right? Women, way in the past, still today, but in the past it was much more sort of dimorphic is the word you'd use. So they were a lot more worried about verbal things and worried about other kinds of communication. Right? They had the young with them. They were teaching them. Men were out hunting, were out killing stuff. No, somebody's going to bring. Somebody brings you the meat. Somebody brings you the nuts and berries. Women got the nuts and berries, and also raised the children. And we're out doing the hunt, right? With spears and rocks and such. So it'd be much. It makes a lot of sense that women would be more tuned into this. I just watched this awesome series called "Walking with Cavemen." It was very good. I actually just got the library to buy it for the when I teach evolutionary psychology, because it's perfect. It's great. You seen like the Walking with Dinosaurs, that kind of thing? It's the same kind of thing, except it's with, you know, ape men. It's awesome. Women, as far as emotions go, express happiness much more easily than men do, and much more readily than men do. Men express anger more readily and more easily. This part of the class is called, really? That's not that obvious? So, you know, one of those things. So men, easier at expressing anger. Women, much more easily express happiness. And again, that's all on average. I couldn't pick out one woman and one guy in the room and say, you're going to be happier more easily and you're going to be angry more easily. Physiologically, why this is, I don't think anybody really knows, but it just is. There was a study done back in about 85, and I can't remember the author, that found that women who, the week before they were menstruating, right, tend to be more angry than average, than they are normally during the week, the month. But that's the same, you know, and then people would always say, well, women can't do this because they have periods and they'll get all angry and they won't think straight. We can't let them be firefighters or fighter pilots. Except that, in fact, you know, the level of anger and distraction sort of thing that women get, that's where men live. No, in fact, if you they also studied men, and a woman with PMS has the same level of anger and rage that a guy has on average, all the time. Right? Yeah, please.
I have a question. How come they're so much scarier then?
Well, I don't know how to answer that without sounding like an idiot, but it seems scarier probably because you're not used to it. Right? Women, when they're, you know, for, again, and not all women really have these really serious symptoms, right? But the ones that do, it's so different from the way they normally behave, right? So, for the other 3 weeks. So it's really noticeable. Whereas people like you and me, we're just pissed off all the time, and it's expected. Right? If we had 1 week a month where we were, you know, I don't know, thinking about unicorns and lollipops and stuff, it would be weird too. Right? Not that women always think of unicorns and lollipops. It was a joke. Don't say that. Don't say that. And if they do good for them, that must be nice. That must be happy. But I mean, I think that's probably why. It's just more noticeable. It's something you see that you wouldn't normally occur to you, right? Because usually things are different than that. I think that's probably why. That's why it's more, as you said, scary. I think noticeable is a better word for it, because it can be scary, I guess. Yep. It's an excellent question. But that's probably why. So the idea that women couldn't be politicians or women couldn't be business leaders and all these other things because they have periods is stupid. Because we let men do those things and they're feeling like that most of the time. Again, on average. So if we're going to communicate our emotions, we can use our eyes, as I mentioned, and that's a perhaps a huge evolutionary thing. Unlike basically, especially like every other primate, except for humans, doesn't really, you don't see whites of their eyes. You don't see them. You do in us. People that are lying, we talked about lie detectors. Liars, actually, this is counterintuitive. Liars make fewer pauses and more gestures than non-liars. So what you do is you get, how do you do these kind of studies? You get people to lie. You get people to come in to the lab and you videotape them and say, here, read this out. And you just make something up that isn't true. And the amazing thing is, they read it with fewer pauses and more gestures. Hello, my name is Steve and I, you know, I'm Dave. That's why I did Steve like that. I know you guys all know I'm Dave. I question whether the people who don't ever come to class know my name. Yeah, why come? Why come to class? Anyway, maybe I'll start taking attendance. Maybe I'll start doing that next year. I can. No, I'm allowed to. Yeah. You miss more than 20%, you can fail. We can do that. I don't do it without trouble. Smacks of effort. So liars don't pause very much and they make more gestures. Almost like they're, yeah, I'm not sure this is why, but it sounds like they're trying to make up for the fact that what they're telling you is complete crap, right? Now, there are cultural differences in body language in general. You think about acceptable social distance, right? How close you can be to somebody to talk and it being not weird, right? Like, I'm talking to Michael here right now, totally reasonable distance. That's weird, isn't it? Yeah. About here even's okay, but it's bordering on the weird. That's getting a little odd, right? Now, if we were somewhere else, even somewhere else in Canada, right? You think of Quebec versus Anglophone, English-speaking Canada. The weird thing about Quebec is it's even true for Anglophone Quebecers, from what I can see, my own sort of like personal experiences. There's a lot more, the social distance can get a lot, it's no big deal about the it's just not as big a deal. People kiss each other there on the cheek and such. It's very weird when you come from a family from Ontario and then you get married to a woman from Quebec and the first time you meet them, they're kissing you. Stop kissing me, it's freaking me out. You can't really say that because they're being nice. Right? So one of the things you often get is misinterpretation, where people that come from a culture where the acceptable distance is a lot closer think that people that come from a different culture, oh, they're very standoffish, those kind of people. They're very kind of aloof. And it's like, no, I'm actually just being polite. And what I call polite, you call aloof. And what you're doing when you're getting so close to me talking, I just find it creepy. Right? So there's those kind of differences that are really important in body language. Personal space is one of them. Gestures are another great one. Right? Gestures are great because, in fact, humans use gestures. It's something we do. Well, even chimps use gestures. You know, the chimps use a begging. When chimps want something from their chimp, they'll kind of get down like that and they'll put their hands out, like just like people begging. They'll do that. It's pretty cool. But there's differences. I mean, human language may have actually evolved out of gestures. We don't know that, but it might have. Until my time machine's complete, we'll never know the real truth. But thing is, sometimes something which is totally reasonable in one place is bad in another place. Right? For example, Richard Nixon, who was the president of the United States from 1968 until 1974, and those of you that don't know a lot about history wonder why he wasn't 8 years, is because he had to resign because he tried to fix an election and ran a secret war in Cambodia. So he had to resign. Nixon was a smart guy, though. Remember I told you this. Nixon was one of Terman's termites. This was not a dumb man. He was a bit paranoid, but he was also wasn't dumb. He lands in Brazil. Okay, state visit, big thing. American president comes. All very exciting. And he lands. Nixon's famous thing, you have to do is the thumbs up. Like, that was one of his favorite. Except in Brazil, when he got off the plane and gave a thumbs up to everybody, that's this. He basically gave them all the finger. Now, the people of Brazil pretty much knew that that's not what it meant in America, but it's still pretty damned funny. So, it's, you know, imagine American president gets off a plane and goes, go screw yourself. It just doesn't seem like the right kind of message he's trying to send, right? Kind of cool. In a weird way, because it tells us about differences, and we're all, you know, the dominant culture here is comes from Europe, so does it in Brazil, but you've got a totally different gesture. If you notice, if you look back in history, Winston Churchill always did the V for victory, right? Like we're going to win the war, which we did, which is good, because it was Hitler. But he always did it that direction. Because in England, that means something else. Most of you probably don't know that. It means women's naughty bits. So Churchill was always careful to do it that way. So you see all these different kinds of gestures, and they're different depending on the place. My wife, who's traveled to Morocco and Algeria, even noticed differences between people in Morocco and people in Algeria. I can't remember what some of these things were. There was something they always did when they said yes, and I think it was in Morocco, and I can't remember what it was. But it was something like, and she's told me, and I went, well, that doesn't mean yes. And you might think that nodding your head always means yes, and saying like this always means no. Well, it does in almost all of the West, except for a certain part of Greece. I think it's either the southern or the northern, that's how it's divided up, where this means yes, and that means no. Everywhere else in the Western society, that's yes and that's no. Right? So there's interesting differences in gestures, again, indicating our emotional state. Now, so those are clearly mediated by culture. For some reason, this means yes, this means no, and this means that's a bad thing you just did. For some reason, that's how it works here, whatever. Whereas, facial expressions, doesn't matter what your culture is. A smile always means happy. It's always a welcoming thing. It's always pleasant. I don't care where you come from. A frown is always something bad. Always. How do you test this? Well, you go to some place and you say to a guy from Papua New Guinea, which is something that a guy named Ekman's done, how would you look, what would your facial expression be if I told you your youngest child just died? It looks just the same as you and me if we look sad. What about if, you know, and they tell them something happy and smile. So fear, anger, happiness, disgust, and surprise are the same everywhere. They're the same everywhere. There's disgust, there's happiness, there's sadness, fear. Probably not surprise, more like fear. You can tell from the pictures, the original research was done in the early 1970s, just by looking at the amount of eye makeup and the hairdo. There's probably an evolutionary basis for this. Chimps, in fact, make expressions, facial expressions, that are universal among chimps. Okay, so any chimp will make the same set of facial expressions. That's not happy, by the way. The chimp smile is not happy. That's fear. That's being really, really scared. So that's fear. Now you might wonder then, well, what about in old movies where they got chimps there? And they're smiling. Well, they just scared the crap out of them and got the film rolling. Which now is sort of sad. Like, you know, Bedtime for Bonzo, one of the movies Ronald Reagan made. Real classic. Bonzo was a chimp. So why the hell smile happy then with us? Here's a theory I've heard posited. I don't know if I believe it, but it's the best explanation I've heard so far. And that's, like, when we smile at someone, you tend to smile back. It's the first thing you do. It's one of those things, almost reflexive, right? You're saying, I'm not a threat, right? You're saying you're not a threat. Well, maybe that's like, I'm afraid of you. Oh, I'm afraid of you, so don't worry, we're not going to fight. Maybe that's where it comes from. That sounds just like a bit of a story to me, but it's the only story I've heard. So I think, you know, it's the only, you know, it's an odd thing. It's an odd thing. Disgust is interesting because it has a function. And you can see the disgust one. What are you doing when you do in disgust? Your face scrunches up, right? Ooh. And in fact, you might go, when you make that face, your tongue kind of curls, like you're getting something out of your mouth. You can do that with a baby You take some vinegar and give it to a baby. Not a lot. I'm not suggesting you do a series of nasty experiments with a baby, with your baby brother or sister or your own child. I'm saying, though, if you ever, like, a little bit of, just for fun, a little bit of vinegar, not a lot, on your finger, and they'll do this. Because they'll be trying to push it out of their mouth. And you can see the disgust face, like, there it is. And that one happens right away. That's probably the first facial expression that we have. After that comes, like, happy. The smile, nothing better than the first time your kid smiles. One of the greatest things in the world. Yeah, please.
Apple raspberry sauce gives the same thing as vinegar.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay. Raspberry sauce. But raspberries are...
Apple sauce.
But that's just gross, though. I mean, is that why? If like somebody doesn't like it? Because everybody's going to find vinegar disgusting. Yeah. Don't do this to your little brother or sister, please, or your kid. I'm just saying if you did, the research has been done. There's no need to collect your own data. But these facial expressions are universal. It's interesting. We have very few... I don't like the word instinct, but let's use them anyway. Instinctive vocalizations, humans. We have very few of them. Right? Because most of our vocalizations are for communication, and very complex communication. What do we have? We've got laughing, right? We've got sobbing, crying. That's about it, right? Most of our verbal communication is for doing complex stuff. Talking about really complicated things. Our nonverbal communication is where we're still dealing with, you might want to call it instinct or whatever. Same sort of thing with, like I said, laughing and sobbing. And we're the only animals that do those things.
Screaming.
Like, yeah, that's probably there too. Yep. Like you're frightened of something, that kind of screaming. Not like just screaming at somebody like I was doing before I started recording today. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, your tone of voice clearly can indicate emotion. There's no doubt there. It's interesting to try to figure out where the heck, when did our verbal communication, when did it stop being just an expression of emotion? There's always some communication with animals. You know, bird song. When birds sing, they're actually sending out a message that says, what? I'm available to mate, because it's males that do that, and get out of my territory. And, you know, complicated things like, well, vervet monkeys have like 10 different kinds of communication systems they use, or sounds they use. But they're pretty much, I don't want to say hardwired, but they're the same across vervet monkeys. So the question is, when is it that we... Or how is it that we stop just doing laughing, screaming for fright, you know, a sobbing, and going, like that? When did that become, that get taken over by language? Hard to say. There's a whole theory that has something to do with us being in these big groups, and the only way you could be in a big group would be to communicate complex ideas to each other because you had to sort of share and things like that. Who knows? Good questions. Not sure anybody really knows the answer to those. Here's another one. This is hilarious. This is a great study. Facial expressions and emotions. Emotions feed off the expressions we are making. This is Duclos et al., 1989. What did they do? This is so clever. Now, instead of even telling people to smile, what they did is they said to people, what we want you to do, see if I have what I need here, I might not. Oh yeah, that'll do. So they took a pencil, I'm going to use a pen, it's a very similar device as you can see. And they said to people, hold this in your teeth for 90 seconds. With your lips open. So I did it for 90 seconds. I'm not going to do it for 90 seconds. But you see with that? Okay. Then they fill out a questionnaire about happiness. People that are made to make look like something that's smiling scored higher in happiness than people that didn't have to, they just held the pencil. Your facial expression is actually making the emotion, not just your emotion making the facial expression. You tell me that's not, first of all, a pretty clever experiment. Also, tell me it doesn't surprise you, because I mean, it surprises me. This is something that's often taken advantage of in therapy, where they tell you, I know you don't feel great right now. Pretend. Act happy. Because it'll help you feel happy. It's an amazing thing. The first time, maybe the second appointment I ever had with a therapist, he told me to do that. He said, you probably already know this. I said, I probably taught it this morning. But it's amazing how that can work. You just be happy. Act happy. Now, that's not going to cure everything that's wrong with you. Please don't misunderstand me. But it's amazing the effect it actually can have. That's a pretty amazing study. So they forced people to smile, and they felt happier. But they aren't actually even smiling. They're just going. See, because in an experiment like this, you wouldn't tell people to smile. Because if you told them to smile, they'd figure out what the experiment's about. It's called demand characteristics of an experiment. And when people figure out what an experiment's about, they tend to try to give you what you want. This is one of the reasons those of you guys that have been participating in the thesis experiments, which, again, thank you very much for, no one ever tells you what the experiment's about completely. They tell you at the end of the experiment. They tell you this is an experiment on blank. And they don't lie to you, but they can't tell you the whole story. Because if they do, you're going to try to give them what they want, even though maybe you don't even think you're doing that. We always have to worry about demand characteristics. Excuse me. Ekman, the guy that did the stuff with the facial expressions, going to Papua New Guinea and saying, make the face you would make if your, you know, kid died or something like that. Ekman has also done some really cool stuff with actors. So he goes to actors, and after they play a role, he gives them questionnaires about their emotion. And it turns out that actors who are judged by other actors to be good actors actually have the emotion that their character had in the play they were just in. So they just do a scene, and then he gives them the questionnaire. The ones that are actually, you know, doing fake rage, or fake happy, or fake crying. I don't know how actors do that, by the way. When they can just cry? How can you just cry? I can't cry. I could probably sit here for like an hour and find enough sad things that I could cry. But I can't just do it like that. It's amazing. It blows my mind. But people that are judged to be good actors by other actors are the ones, in fact, whose their characters' emotions actually affect their emotions. And I guess that shouldn't surprise us when you watch something and you say, oh, that felt like he really was happy, really was sad. Well, he actually probably really was. This explains probably why a lot of actors do things like, you know, ask directors and stuff, why am I doing this? Why am I doing that? Sometimes they get into character all day, hear about this, and they don't want to leave the character they're in. They're making film or TV shows. Then again, I heard Harrison Ford on TV once, and I think it was Letterman asked him, do you ever really get into your character and make people call you by the character's name, and you act like the character? He said, no, Dave, I do let's pretend acting. And he's considered a pretty good actor, so what the heck. Unlike, say, oh, I don't know, let's think of Kevin Costner, who just plays Kevin Costner in every movie he's in. Right? He's just Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner is Kevin Costner in Robin Hood. Remember that one where he has an accent until about two-thirds of the way through the movie, then his English accent, his faux English accent, disappears two-thirds of the way through the movie? Suddenly he's back like he's in Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. I don't get art. Anyway. So these are people making facial expressions, part of acting. And now they feel the actual emotions that their character feels. Pretty amazing. I'll do a couple points here and we'll quit. The experience of emotion itself, emotions seem to have a few different dimensions to them. Some emotions are pleasant, some are unpleasant. Nobody likes fear. You might like it afterwards when it's like, oh boy, I got through that. But you know, like the jumping with the bungee jumping. You know, or the even worse, the roller coaster. I think I trust a giant elastic more than I trust a roller coaster held together with rickety old bolts. I don't know why. One of those things like, oh, I lived. How joyous. Yes, I'm going to jump out of an airplane and I don't have to. No, I will jump out of an airplane when I have to. That's different. But if I don't have to, I'm not jumping out of an airplane or off a bridge with my feet tied to a giant elastic. That's insane. It's my view. But, you know, when it's done, maybe. But typically, while you're afraid, it's not fun. Some things are arousing. Some are sleep, make you sleepy. I guess that's the only way I can think of putting this. Like, joy is arousing, and sadness makes you kind of tired. You know, it sort of turns you down. Okay. Some are long-lasting, some are short. More or less. Like, you think about happiness. Again, let's say your team won the Super Bowl. You like the big New Orleans Saints fan. You might be happy all week. Surprise doesn't last long. It's not like you ever have a surprise party and you walk in, they say surprise. You don't for the rest of the night go, like, it's gone. Right? I'm still so surprised! Right? It's a short-lived thing. So you think of different emotions, they have these different kind of qualities to them. And I think that's a pretty reasonable place to stop, and we'll continue talking about this on Wednesday. Thanks, guys. There must be something more. There must be.
podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.